Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. Today is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Just pause there for a moment. It's not like I say that each and every morning just out of rote. It is a reminder to you that regardless of what lies ahead, regardless of what you're facing today, as a person given over to Jesus Christ, we are going to rejoice. We will rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. You say to yourself, the news and my life and the challenges I'm facing are not joyful. Well, that's why we must know the secret of being content in all circumstances, the secret that the Apostle Paul knew. And the way that you come into contact with on a regular basis that good news, that great good news, that astounding mystery of who Christ is and what God has done for us through Christ, is by immersing ourselves in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. And so I ask you again this morning, where in the Word are you today? Where in the Word are you today? You and I are going to spend time this morning surveying lots of words that are out there in the culture. We are going to talk about everything from a new cryptocurrency to whether or not Medicare for All is a good idea to what churches can do in response to abuse and how we can prevent further abuse within our houses of worship. We're going to talk about abortion. We're going to talk about racism. We're going to talk about immigration. And in the midst of all those conversations, we are going to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the matters of the day. And we can only do that if we actually have apprehended for ourselves the mind of Christ. And how do we do that? How do we cultivate the mind of Christ? Well, we do so by immersing ourselves in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. We come to know God. And you come to know God only if you are in a restored relationship with him through Jesus Christ, and the Holy Spirit is actively operating within you. And you are then, in turn, actively cooperating with the Holy Spirit in order that the words on the page of the Bible might not just be words on a page, but actually penetrate and bring us through a process of transformation into greater conformity with who Christ is. Because we don't start the day, we don't enter into the world as our natural selves, as people who are possessed of the mind of Christ. That is something that has to be cultivated, and it's cultivated through a study of the Word of God. So let me ask you again, where in the Word are you today? You're going to be lots of places in the world, but where are you going to be in the Word? Good place to start, you know, is the abiding passage in the Gospel of John. Spend a little time in John 14, 15, 16, and 17. If you want a place to immerse yourself and you're saying, I'm not in a Bible study where I am, you know, actively working my way through a particular book of the Bible, you know, just go to the end of the book of John, kind of the middle portion, and work your way to the end of it. Spend a little time getting to know again who Jesus is, that you might know who you are and that you might know who you're called to be. So there you go. Where in the Word are you today? Hey, Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute is up next. He and I are going to talk about Libra. Libra is a new cryptocurrency. You may not even know what a cryptocurrency is. So there you go. There's lots of conversation going on in the world about things that we need to be aware of. This is a new one. So Libra up next.
This is my right, a right given by God.
Joining me now, Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. He tweets at The Rights Writer. Ben, welcome back.
Good morning, Carmen.
Good morning. All right. So I better start with when we talk about when we start a conversation about something weird, like cryptocurrency, I think we have some terms that we have to define. So we're going to you and I are going to attempt to have a conversation that neither for which it's possible neither one of us is yet fully equipped. But it's a conversation that's happening in the culture. And I know a little bit about blockchain and Bitcoin, and I know a little bit about Facebook, and I know a little bit about the concerns and people and that fears people have about globalism and one world currencies. And so that's really my interest in wading into this little bit weird conversation this morning with you. So let's just start with, what do you know at this point about Libra?
Right. Libra is a new cryptocurrency that's been promoted now by a consortium of groups, but the most prominent one is Facebook. And of course, Facebook has billions of users around the world. Across its platforms, if you throw in WhatsApp and its instant messenger and other applications, it has a span of almost a third of humanity that uses it in one way or another. 1.7 billion people in the world don't have bank accounts, so this could give potentially people who don't have access to the ability to use online financial instruments. This would give them a tool to do that. Now that's very exciting in its own way. Since it's a non-governmental currency with a consortium of right now about 24 groups, a little more than that, but potentially 100 partners will come together to support this currency with real assets. And this will be transferable everywhere across the globe. You simply log on to your phone or log on to Facebook, but you don't have to have a Facebook account to use it. And you can transfer money just like you would from a bank account. But instead, you don't have to convert it from if you're sending money across the world, then you don't have to convert it from U.S. dollars to another currency. It's simply its own currency, and it's everywhere, which is good in certain I'm excited about it in some theories, and I'm very concerned about how it could be done in practice.
Sure. And I think any time that we start talking about something that would be utterly decentralized, and when we talk about something that would have very few, if any, government controls, there's a positive and a negative. There's like an immediate glee that we'd be so free, and wouldn't that be so fun to be so free? And then there is the immediate, oh my goodness, with that kind of freedom, I fear those who would use that freedom as license to do naughty things. And so I think that those are the kinds of concerns that I'd be lifting up in conversation with others from a Christian worldview. Is there any particular way of transacting, with one another that's any more Christian than any other way? Like this I think really gets down to the question of, if we looked back over the course of time, and it's not as if we've always had the U.S. dollar. It's not as if we've always had the kind of banking systems we have now. And so, the time will come when those two things will also be very different. And so when we think about Christians and we think about Christians being a part of an economy of any kind, locally or globally, is there any way that a Christian should be thinking about those things differently because we're Christian?
Right. Well, you make a very good point there, which is that we haven't always had government money, or we haven't always had a certain reserve currency that was recognized around the world like the U.S. dollar is. One of the criticisms that was sparked by this was the finance minister of France, who said only governments can issue currency. And that really has not been the case through a lot of history. Matter of fact, according to Peter Marshall in, I believe it was The Power and Glory, that book, at one time in Zanesville, Ohio, there were 230 banks all issuing their own banknotes, independent of the government. So we have a long history of that. The trouble is that everyone who uses that has to trust and rely upon the people who are involved in issuing that, that the currency will be backed by real assets and they can actually use and redeem those when it comes time. A currency is just a mode of exchange, so we don't have to barter with one another. I don't have to give you two cows for three watermelons or whatever the case may be. We can simply
that would be a good deal. That would be a good deal for you.
Be a great deal. So you know, you end up using something that everyone agrees has value, and that's the real case with this. Is we have to agree whatever we exchange has a mutually recognized value, whether that's in gold, which you know has traditionally been the case, and no government sets the price of gold. It's simply the supply of gold in the world. That was the primary driver of currency and currency values all over the world, including the United States, until really the onset of the New Deal. So, and in one sense or another, up until the Nixon administration. So that's what's most important, is that we all have an understanding that this currency has a real value. Now, since it doesn't have government control, there are certain concerns about who would be using that and for what purposes they might be transferring these funds.
Okay, Ben, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about Medicare for All. People are going to be hearing a lot about Medicare for All. They're going to be hearing about it from both sides of the political aisle, and we want to take it up from a Christian worldview. So I'm going to continue my conversation in just a moment with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. We'll be right back. Continuing my conversation with Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. Ben, before we move away from the Libra cryptocurrency to a conversation about Medicare for All, I know you have some concerns about Libra. What are those?
Well, just very briefly, the concerns that I have are, of course, this is Facebook, which has a tremendous amount of social information on everybody across its 2.7 billion users. We know that it has unbelievable reserves of information on what we think, what we believe, our political and religious views, and so on. When Facebook is involved with this currency, we'll also have an unbelievable amount of financial information that makes it susceptible to hackers, which is concerning. But it also means one of the partners is PayPal, which has banned Christian and moral conservatives from using their platform at various times. You could see a concern where people could be raided and even banned from using the currency based on their point of view. And since it's a private currency, there is really no recourse, just as we're finding out people don't have an individual right to use Facebook or Twitter. They can be banned. The same thing could be true of this currency.
All right. So I wrote this down this morning in anticipation of our conversation. Amazon, Apple, Google, Samsung, and Facebook, in that order, are already the five most powerful companies in the world. They're all multinational, and none of them are particularly accountable to any form of government. And some of them are not very friendly to Christianity and Christian concerns. So I think that you and I share concerns about this. And my guess is we will circle back around to this conversation. I just read this morning that Uber wants to be our one-stop shopping for literally all things transportation. And so I think that you know, this conversation about our multinational corporations ultimately supplanting governments in terms of how we interact with one another, it's a really fruitful conversation for us to continue having in the future. Let's transition right now, though, to a conversation about Medicare for All. It looks as if from both sides of the aisle, affection for this idea is waning, and yet we certainly have some candidates vying to be our next president who continue to push for such an idea. Tell us where we are in the Medicare for All conversation.
Well, sure. Bernie Sanders has advanced a bill for Medicare for All. There were a series of House hearings on it just this past week. And what's concerning, multiple Democratic candidates have signed on and said they support this legislation. However, the legislation is problematic for Christians because it mandates coverage of what they call comprehensive reproductive services. And everyone who is pro-life knows exactly what that means. That means public funding for abortion. It also says that all healthcare providers would have to provide anything that is covered by this, quote, without discrimination, which would be a way of eviscerating conscience rights. Christian conservatives who do not believe in abortion or perhaps physician-assisted suicide would then be compelled, according to this, to participate in these kinds of matters because they are publicly funded. We had a discussion a few weeks ago about Canada, and that's precisely the logic that an Ontario appeals court used in order to compel those who are involved in the provision of medical care, both doctors and nurses, to continue to be involved in the provision of services that violates their conscience. So that's a concern. When it comes to the actual question of Medicare for all, you're right that there's been some concern as people realize this would abolish private insurance. And so even Democrats are leaning toward a more moderate version of that.
Yeah, it's a horrible idea. That may sound like I'm passing judgment on an idea. That's a horrible idea. Okay, so anyway, our healthcare system needs reform, but this is not the way to do it. That would be my personal opinion on the matter. Charitable giving. We now have the report that it gets issued every single year in terms of, you know, this deep dive look at charitable giving in the United States of America for the prior year. And so one of the things that you and I now know about giving is that it declined last year, which is really actually kind of stunning because charitable giving in the United States of America is very robust. The economy is good. And so we have to ask ourselves this question, like, why would charitable giving have taken a downturn last year? And I think, is it tied to the fact that many Americans now do not itemize their tax deductions, but simply take the standard deduction, which is now twice as big as it used to be? Just weigh in on this and what you think you're seeing. I think we will have to circle back around to this in the future to dig a little deeper.
Well, Carmen, you put your finger on the most important part of this. You've got your hand on the lever, which is exactly the tax code. The Giving USA report says that Americans gave $292 billion last year. I don't want to seem as though we're in crisis. We give more than every other country in the world. That's wonderful. But it's a decrease. It's a decrease of a little over 1%, down from $295 billion the year before. Now, where this has come up, and you're right, the only other time that this has happened in recent history has been during the Great Recession. So when the economy is going well and when Americans have the opportunity to give, they always give, even during the long recovery from the recession when the Americans were really struggling, giving continued to increase. So the reason for it is very simple. People respond to incentives. President Trump doubled the standard deduction, so people don't itemize their taxes. The reason that that's important is one of the main tax write-offs is giving to charity. People say that you should be motivated to give no matter what your tax write-off might be, and that should not be your main concern. That should be the way it is. People should stop for red lights. People should love everyone that they meet. We don't live in that world of, unfortunately, I wish that we did. And Lord willing, the Holy Spirit will continue to guide us to that. But many people really do give money, in part because it keeps them from having to give the money to the federal government, where the government will use it for a purpose that it does not approve of, and a charity will give to a purpose that it does approve of. So since that amount has been doubled, people don't have to itemize. They're getting money back. And so charitable giving has gone down as a tax strategy. That's concerning. Generally, I'm against making social policy through the tax code. I don't think that's what the tax code is for, but I think that the charitable deduction does so much good for so much of society. It's well worth keeping.
So I did have one more thought about this, and I would have to really dig down into the weeds of how the report is put together. But I am kind of wondering, Ben, if there's some giving happening out there that's at such a micro level. It's so much person to person now. It's not tracked at all. I'm kind of wondering about, you know, how next generation people give online. They give over their phone. They give in ways that are they're not even tracking, right? They're just giving out of their heart. Yeah. They're giving in a moment. And if they were asked, how much money did you give? They probably wouldn't even know.
Yeah, well, and some of this can't be monetized. You know, I have friends who are millennials who are so much more involved in giving face-to-face than our generations are, and thank God for it. One of them lives in Washington, D.C., and he very wisely doesn't give money necessarily to people in the form of currency, but he drives around. His wife bakes bread and makes sandwiches, and he gives homemade bread and sandwiches to anyone he sees who looks as though they need it. Now, that costs money. It's a charitable – it's obviously charitable, and it cost him something. But there's no – the money went to the store. So that's not tracked by charity at all. Mm-hmm. And like you, I think that there's a rising generation that wants to be involved person to person, like the Good Samaritan, caring firsthand. And that's not being captured. So I think you're right. That's part of that change as well.
Yeah, I'm thinking about people who buy, you know, who buy socks and the second pair is going to a homeless shelter. People who buy blankets through Sackcloth and Ashes and the second blanket is going to a homeless shelter. I don't think any of that is tracked in terms of this kind of charitable giving. So you and I will continue this conversation. It is interesting. It is robust. I love talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us. I know it's a busy week for you guys at Acton. And so blessings upon the Institute this week as you all convene and study together and bring more robust thoughts to the conversation going forward. Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute, thank you so much.
Thank you, and blessings from the Acton University. God bless.
We'll be right back. So I'm wondering if you have seen the viral video of CareNet CEO and President Roland Warren in response to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's comments to the Des Moines Register last Tuesday. Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, who is one of the 20-plus Democratic presidential candidates, said in a Des Moines Register interview just last week that passing protective pro-life laws is akin to being racist. Here is her quote. Imagine saying it's okay to appoint a judge who's racist or anti-Semitic or homophobic. Asking someone to appoint someone who takes away basic human rights of any group of people in America, well, I don't think those are political issues anymore. All these efforts by President Trump and other ultra-radical conservative judges and justices to impose their faith on America, on Americans, is contrary to our Constitution. This is, again, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand last week to the Des Moines Register. There is no moral equivalency when you come to racism. I do not believe there's a moral equivalency when it comes to changing laws that deny women reproductive freedom. So those of you who are pro-life, Kirsten Gillibrand thinks you are a racist. Roland Warren, who happens to be black, and also the president of CareNet, a national Christ-centered movement of more than 1,000 life-affirming pregnancy centers, is going to be here next to tell me why, you know, as a pro-life advocate and a black man, he's actually not racist. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
How did millennials get the different values they hold? This is Jim Garlow. For millennials, things like biblical truth, moral absolutes, and traditional values are demonized. Why? They are bombarded 24/7 from the media and their teachers with epithets describing supposed enemies. Conservatives and Christians are often labeled as racist oppressors and homophobes. Never mind that the accusations are false, their professors and social media's branding sticks. Millennials have also been indoctrinated to believe America's founding fathers were terrible white slave-owning racists. Again, it matters not that most of these men started and participated in anti-slavery societies and eventually freed any slaves they owned. There's only one way to combat these falsehoods. Become well-versed in the truth and then reflect it in conversation with as many millennials who will listen. There's more at wellversed.world.
Whatever you do, just don't look back. Somebody needs a lot to have.
Okay, just one little clarification there. Millennials are now all adults. They are 22 and over. The youngest millennials are now 22 years old. So if you want to talk about impacting people in emerging generations, people who are still in school, you actually have to be talking to generations who are younger than millennials. So anyway, I just had to throw that in there because I'm not actually sure there you go. Okay, I have an exciting conversation planned right now with Roland Warren. For those of you who have not seen what is now a viral video of Roland responding to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's accusation that those of us who are pro-life are we are racist. I think she misunderstands the issue, and obviously Roland agrees with that. Roland happens to be black. He is the president of CareNet, which is a national Christ-centered movement of more than 1,000 life-affirming pregnancy centers. He shared a video answering Senator Gillibrand's charge that she made to the Des Moines Register last Tuesday. That video went viral. He's here to share with us his reaction and response, and then the reactions and responses he's received since then. So, Roland, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Well, glad to be with you. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a joy to have you here. You are a joyful spirit. You are a life-affirming person. I love the work that you did in the Fatherhood Initiative, and I want to get to that conversation as well. But
okay.
I think I'll just
Great.
Lead
Thank
off with
you.
This. Yeah, I think I'll just lead off with this. You know, as a person who's life-affirming and pro-life, are you a racist?
Well, no, I'm not. And you know, as I said in the video, you know, I have my mother was a black person. My father was a black person. Some of my best friends are black people. I love black people. And I just thought it was really important. You know, I got to go to family reunions and things of that nature. And I want to make sure that folks understand that I'm not a racist. And obviously she's making a parallel between someone who has a pro-life perspective and someone who's racist. And I just thought it was really appropriate because to me, in a large measure, it's an offensive kind of thing because it actually it minimizes what racism or a racist actually does, particularly from a historical perspective, because, you know, folks like that, you know, enslaved people who look like me, they dehumanized people who look like me, lynched people who look like me, denied the vote to people who look like me. And what they were about was really just kind of denying people what we have sort of enshrined in our founding documents, this notion of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They wanted to deny all that. And when you think about a pro-life perspective, it's exactly the opposite. What we're trying to do is actually ensure that folks in the womb and outside the womb have an opportunity for life, which is the first. Because if you don't have life, you can't have liberty, and certainly you can't have the pursuit of happiness. So it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly backwards. And I think the other point here, someone who really wanted to kind of carry out a racist perspective to its logical conclusion wouldn't even want a person like me to ever exist. And I tell you that abortion's been the most effective of anything in terms of affecting people who look like me, because over 19 million black babies have been aborted. We're only 12% of the population, 35% of the abortion. So, frankly, that's the most effective tool. If your perspective, which is the ultimate goal of anybody who's like an ultra racist, would be, well, we don't even want those folks to exist. And so, It concerns me that someone would try to use that line of logic in order to support their position.
So, Roland, I think we should give those numbers again, because when I consider the disproportionate impact that abortion has had on people of color in this country, I think there's no question that Margaret Sanger, who fought this, ginned up this idea, and who was a eugenicist and was absolutely interested in a racist ideology, there's no question that at least at some level, the goal of abortion and its use and its advocacy in this country is to suppress people of color, to eliminate them from ever being born. So give us those numbers again. How many black children have been aborted since Roe v. Wade?
Yeah. Sure, it's nearly 20 million, and like I said, we're such a small percentage of the population. And you know, from my perspective, you know, I don't necessarily try to ascribe to some of the abortion providers that they are necessarily racist. So you can kind of some people can maybe go there, but that really is not my point in a broader sense. Even if your intent is not to be that, there's a disparate impact in the black community. And that's an argument that certainly folks who are on the other side or liberals or progressives should understand, because if you think about, like, why are there concerns around voter ID laws or any of those kinds of things? I mean, even if your intent, they would say, is not to limit certain kinds of people, the reality is they would say, well, these certain kinds of people are less likely to have IDs. So even though your intent may not necessarily be one that's nefarious, the outcome is. And I think that that's a key point, really, for folks to understand, especially in the black community. So I don't try to make that argument necessarily, but it's clear that there's a disparate impact from abortion. And that's the thing that we should be very concerned about. And that's the thing that I raise certainly in the video and the thing that I've been raising with folks in my community for some time. So anyway, that's kind of a way to kind of think about that as well. Even if you want to ascribe to some folks on the other side a virtuous perspective in terms of maybe their intent, but the reality is the outcome is not one that is good for folks who look like me.
Okay, that is such a helpful way of articulating it. So thank you for sharing that. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to address this question. I think there are a lot of people, Roland, who say, hey, people like Roland and Carmen, they are pro-life. They advocate this, but they're not really pro-life when it comes down to making these kinds of decisions for themselves and in their own families. Your personal testimony is exactly contrary to that argument. Like, you bring a witness to this conversation that's personally powerful. So when we come back from the break, I want you to share your personal pro-life story. I am talking with Roland Warren. He is the president and CEO of CareNet. You can find them online at CareNet, and you can also find them on Twitter at Inspire Life Now. We'll be right back.
There's never been a moment I was not held beside your arms.
Continuing my conversation now with Roland Warren from CareNet. You can find them online at care.net.org. You can find them on Twitter at Inspire Life Now. Roland, this is a personal reality for you. So I'm not going to spoil it. You tell us your pro-life story.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I tell people often that there used to be this old commercial called the Hair Club for Men. Some people might remember it. You might not be old enough, but this guy was the president of the Hair Club for Men, and he would always, at the end of the commercials, put up a picture of him with a bald head, and he, of course, had lots of hair, and says, "I'm not just the president, I'm a client." You know, that perspective. And, you know, I have a lot of that in terms of, you know, my passion around CareNet and why I'm here. Because when I was a 20-year-old college student, I got my girlfriend pregnant. We were both undergraduates at Princeton. I was a junior. She was a sophomore. We were both Christians at the time, obviously not doing something that Christians should have been doing. Got pregnant. When she went to the student services, nurse came out, told her, "Look, it's positive, you're pregnant." And then without missing a beat, said, "Now, of course, you're going to have an abortion." And, she said, "No, I don't want to have an abortion. I want to get married. I want to have my baby." And she said, "Well, it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense. How are you going to graduate from Princeton with a baby? And what do you want to do when you graduate?" She said, "Well, I want to become a doctor." She said, "My gosh, how are you going to become a doctor with a baby, graduate with a baby from Princeton?" Anyway, we ended up getting married and kind of followed through on that and got married. And she graduated, not actually with one child, but with two, and became a doctor. She's been practicing over 25 years. And so, you know, I saw firsthand in my own life, the challenge that you can have. And the most convenient thing, so to speak, would have been to kind of have the abortion and just kind of move on. But we knew that, you know, we didn't want to couple one mistake with another mistake, which in a large measure would have been a much larger mistake. And ironically, that child that we were encouraged to abort, you know, smart kid, ended up going to Harvard, smarter than both of us. I mean, so I've seen personally the impact of, you know, a life-affirming decision and the commitment to marriage and family and what God can do there. So I always try to encourage folks that even though in that moment you may not be able to see your way forward, but what you can see is the promises that God has. And one of the big challenges for me is that, you know, folks who try to encourage around abortion, they try to get you to make your decision based on the uncertainty of what you don't know and to reject the certainty of what you do know, that there's a child growing inside her. And it's a life, not a life worth sacrificing, but a life worth sacrificing for. And I was just thankful that in that moment, by God's grace, you know, my girlfriend, now wife of 37 years, and I had the clarity in that moment to take that perspective and focus not on what we didn't know, because we didn't know. We had no way to take care of ourselves. Essentially, our parents didn't pay anymore, and here we were. But what we knew was the certainty that there was a life growing inside of her. And so I always try to encourage people around that, and that's a big reason why the CareNet issue is a CareNet issue, and this life issue is so important to me.
So one of the things I love about your story is that it's not just the story of a sophomore in college who found herself pregnant and then had to walk a journey by herself. You immediately recognized that you were a dad and you bore an equal responsibility for what the two of you had done and what had been produced. And then the life that would be forever different because of that, but also the precious gift of life that was being produced through that. And so that's really where your fatherhood journey begins. And I would love for you to speak now to young men Because there's a testimony in all of this that I think is completely lost in our culture today, and it's the pro-life conversation that's directed to young men.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because I had grown up without my father. My mother became pregnant the first time when she was 16, 17 years old. So I was raised in a single mother home with an absent father, and that was the world that I lived in. But, you know, it's interesting. I went to church, and because I went to church, you know, I always say it's difficult to be what you don't see. And what happened, even though I didn't have a father in my home, what I saw was men in church were being a husband to her and a father to their children. And so that cast a vision in me so that when we had this pregnancy, fatherhood and husbandhood, so to speak, were linked together. I didn't disconnect those things because of what was modeled based on what I saw in church. And that's really the part, in my view, in terms of when I first came to care, that coming through the fatherhood work, that was the observation that I had, that so much of the focus of the pro-life movement is about the mother and the child, but not focused on engaging the guy. And when we did research, what we found was when we surveyed women who had had abortions, we found that the most influential person in her decision to have an abortion was the guy. The most influential. Clearly, it was my wife's body and choice legally. But the reality is that my decision impacted that choice because it gave her ability to see that she could accomplish the things that she wanted to do. And so that's a big myth from my perspective. And part of that also has to do with the fact that we only focus on the sanctity of life issue. But when you think about it, there are two issues here. It's not just the sanctity of life. It's the sanctity of marriage and family as God designed as well. Those two things together. Why? Because 86% of the women that have abortions are unmarried. So if you really want to kind of change what's happening around the abortion issue, you can't do it just with a sanctity of life narrative, which means that you're basically solving for a live baby, so to speak, which is God-honoring. Don't get me wrong. But it's not just about saving a baby. It's about raising a child. And what we want to do is raise that child in a home that's consistent with God's design, which means you're not going to get there without encouraging men to do like not just encouraging women to do what Mary did, say, let it be unto me as you have said, and ascribe themselves the virtue and character of Mary. But you also need to be challenging men to ascribe to themselves the virtue and the character of Joseph, who said essentially the same thing. I'll be a husband to you, and I'll be a father to the child growing inside of you. And so that narrative, which I call the nativity narrative, is so important for us to communicate, especially as Christians. And I believe in some way, shape, or form, as a 20-year-old, God had kind of implanted that into my head, and I kind of walked in, and I'm so thankful that I did.
Roland, I can tell you, everyone listening to us right now is totally falling in love with you. I don't know if that's an appropriate thing to say or not to say. Like, I guarantee you that people are having exactly the response that I'm having, which is that I love this guy, and I love the way your mom raised you, and I already love the church you grew up in. And I think the role of the church in all of this is essential and important. You obviously experienced in the life of a fellowship of believers something that gave you not only a sense of identity, but a sense of purpose and who you are as a man after God's own heart and what that meant to you, not only in the pursuit of academic excellence and business acumen, but also this sense of calling and passion for your wife and your family and the lives of other people. This is not something that comes by anything other than devoted fellowship with the Lord. So let's take, I'm going to stomp a Paul here on the schedule for just a second. I'm talking offline there to my producer. Let's Roland, I want you to speak directly to young people who are listening right now and share the gospel, because you have a testimony to speak to people that I don't have.
Well, you know, I tell you, and I thank you so much for your kind words. I'm humbled by them, and I appreciate that. But really, what I'm challenging folks around is really the narrative that's laid out in Scripture. You know, Christ said, "I came that you might have life, and have that life abundantly." And so, basically, when I even talk about the life issue, I see that we can't just be pro-life; we have to be pro-abundant life. And when you say, well, what does being pro-abundant life mean? Well, it means that, you know, we want not just physical life for those around us, those inside the womb and those outside the womb, but we also want that unique type of spiritual life that only comes from a relationship with Christ. Because that's Christ's why statement. I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. That's why he came. And so we should want that for everyone. And I think whether you're talking about it in a pro-life perspective in terms of we've got to move beyond being pro-life to be pro-abundant life or in any other area of your life, that's the call. And I think that more than anything else, I think young people, older people, we all want abundance and we all want abundant life. And that only comes through a relationship with God. And certainly from my perspective, God gave me an opportunity to go through this situation with the unplanned pregnancy. And look, my life hasn't been a perfect trajectory up. I've made certainly huge mistakes along the way. But what I do know is that God is there all the way. And that if, when you make a bad decision, if you don't continue to walk in that, and you kind of anchor yourself against the abundant life that God has called us all to and has desired for all of us, the outcomes are so much better than what we would plan for ourselves. And so I'm thankful for that.
Thank you so much. I look forward to continuing this conversation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Friends, if you're listening, you can find CareNet at care.net.org. You can find them on Twitter at Inspire Life Now. You can, on the website, you can join the conversation. You can take 30 seconds to sign a pledge against abortion and infanticide. And if you want to connect with Roland, you can do so via an email that's available to you there. Roland Warren, thank you so much for your life, your
thank
testimony,
you.
Your witness, and your leadership. Friends, you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. All right, so in just a minute, we're going to have a conversation with Alan Cross about immigration. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.